so different now from the fashionable young man who had asked her to be his wife that she could not help thinking of him and talking with him as if he were an entirely new acquaintance. They had turned off the avenue and were going up the street to Rachel's home. It was the same street where Roland had asked Rachel why she could not love him. They were both stricken with a sudden shyness as they went on. Rachel had not forgotten that day, and Roland could not. She finally broke a long silence by asking what she had not found words for before. In your work with the clubmen, with your old acquaintances, what sort of reception do they give you? How do you approach them? What do they say? Roland was relieved when Rachel spoke. He answered quickly, "Oh, it depends on the man. A good many of them think I'm a crank. I've kept my membership up and am in good standing in that way. I try to be wise and not provoke any unnecessary criticism. But you would be surprised to know how many of the men have responded to my appeal. I could hardly make you believe that only a few nights ago a dozen men became honestly and earnestly engaged in a conversation over religious matters. I have had the great joy of seeing some of the men give up bad habits and begin a new life. What would Jesus do? I keep asking it. The answer comes slowly, for I am feeling my way slowly. One thing I have found out. The men are not fighting shy of me. I think that is a good sign. Another thing, I have actually interested some of them in the rectangle work, and when it is started up, they will give something to help make it more powerful. And in addition to all the rest, I have found a way to save several of the young fellows from going to the bad in gambling." Roland spoke with enthusiasm. His face was transformed by his interest in the subject, which had now become a part of his real life. Rachel again noted the strong, manly tone of his speech. With it all, she knew there was a deep, underlying seriousness which felt the burden of the cross even while carrying it with joy. The next time she spoke, it was with a swift feeling of justice due to Roland and his new life. "Do you remember I reproached you once for not having any purpose worth living for?" she asked, while her beautiful face seemed to Roland more beautiful than ever when he had won sufficient self-control to look up. "I want to say I feel the need of saying, in justice to you now, that I honor you for your courage and your obedience to the promise you have made as you interpret the promise. The life you are living is a noble one." Roland trembled. His agitation was greater than he could control. Rachel could not help seeing it. They walked along in silence. At last, Roland said, "I thank you. It has been worth more to me than I can tell you to hear you say that." He looked into her face for one moment. She read his love for her in that look, but he did not speak. When they separated, Rachel went into the house, and sitting down in her room, she put her face in her hands and said to herself, "I am beginning to know what it means to be loved by a noble man. I shall love Roland Page after all. What am I saying? Rachel Winslow, have you forgotten?" She rose and walked back and forth. She was deeply moved. Nevertheless, it was evident to herself that her emotion was not that of regret or sorrow. Somehow a glad new joy had come to her. She had entered another circle of experience, and later in the day she rejoiced with a very strong and sincere gladness that her Christian discipleship found room in this crisis for her feeling. It was indeed a part of it, for if she was beginning to love Roland Page, it was the Christian man she had begun to love, and the other never would have moved her to this great change. And Roland, as he went back, treasured a hope that had been a stranger to him since Rachel had said no that day. In that hope he went on with his work as the days sped on, and at no time was he more successful in reaching and saving his old acquaintances than in the time that followed that chance meeting with Rachel Winslow. The summer had gone, and Raymond was once more facing the rigor of her winter season. Virginia had been able to accomplish a part of her plan for capturing the rectangle, as she called it, but the building of houses in the field, the transforming of its bleak, bare aspect into an attractive park, all of which was included in her plan, was a work too large to be completed that fall after she had secured the property. But $1 million in the hands of a person who truly wants to do with it as Jesus would ought to accomplish wonders for humanity in a short time. and Henry Maxwell, going over to the scene of the new work one day after a noon hour with the shopmen, was amazed to see how much had been done outwardly. Yet he walked home thoughtfully, and on his way he could not avoid the question of the continual problem thrust upon his notice by the saloon. How much had been done for the rectangle after all? Even counting Virginia's and Rachel's work and Mr. Gray's, where had it actually counted in any visible quantity? Of course, he said to himself, the redemptive work begun and carried on by the Holy Spirit in his wonderful displays of power in the first church and in the tent meetings had had its effect upon the life of Raymond. But as he walked past saloon after saloon and noted the crowds going in and coming out of them, as he saw the wretched dens, as many as ever apparently, as he caught the brutality and squalor and open misery and degradation on countless faces of men and women and children, he sickened at the sight. He found himself asking how much cleansing could $1 million poured into this cesspool accomplish. Was not the living source of nearly all the human misery they sought to relieve untouched as long as the saloons did their deadly but legitimate work? What could even such unselfish Christian discipleship as Virginia's and Rachel's do to lessen the stream of vice and crime so long as the great spring of vice and crime flowed as deep and strong as ever? Was it not a practical waste of beautiful lives for these young women to throw themselves into this earthly hell, when for every soul rescued by their sacrifice, the saloon made two more that needed rescue? He could not escape the question. It was the same that Virginia had put to Rachel in her statement that, in her opinion, nothing really permanent would ever be done until the saloon was taken out of the rectangle. Henry Maxwell went back to his parish work that afternoon with added convictions on the license business. But if the saloon was a factor in the problem of the life of Raymond, no less was the first church and its little company of disciples who had pledged to do as Jesus would do. Henry Maxwell, standing at the very center of the movement, was not in position to judge of its power as someone from the outside might have done. But Raymond itself felt the touch in very many ways, not knowing all the reasons for the change. The winter was gone and the year was ended, the year which Henry Maxwell had fixed as the time during which the pledge should be kept to do as Jesus would do. Sunday, the anniversary of that one a year ago, was in many ways the most remarkable day that the First Church ever knew. It was more important than the disciples in the First Church realized. The year had made history so fast and so serious that the people were not yet able to grasp its significance. And the day itself, which marked the completion of a whole year of such discipleship, was characterized by such revelations and confessions that the immediate actors in the events themselves could not understand the value of what had been done, or the relation of their trial to the rest of the churches and cities of the country. Chapter 19. Letter from Reverend Calvin Bruce, D.D., of the Nazareth Avenue Church, Chicago, to Reverend Philip A. Caxton, D.D., New York City. My dear Caxton, it is late Sunday night, but I am so intensely awake and so overflowing with what I have seen and heard that I feel driven to write you now some account of the situation in Raymond as I have been studying it, and as it has apparently come to a climax today. So this is my only excuse for writing so extended a letter at this time. You remember Henry Maxwell in the seminary? I think you said the last time I visited you in New York that you had not seen him since we graduated. He was a refined, scholarly fellow, you remember, and when he was called to the First Church of Raymond within a year after leaving the seminary, I said to my wife, Raymond has made a good choice. Maxwell will satisfy them as a sermonizer. He has been here 11 years, and I understand that up to a year ago, he had gone on in the regular course of the ministry, giving good satisfaction and drawing good congregations. His church was counted the largest and wealthiest church in Raymond. All the best people attended it, and most of them belonged. The quartet choir was famous for its music, especially for its soprano, Miss Winslow, of whom I shall have more to say. And on the whole, as I understand the facts, Maxwell was in a comfortable berth, with a very good salary, pleasant surroundings, not a very exacting parish of refined, rich, respectable people. Such a church and parish is nearly all the young men of the seminary in our time look forward to as very desirable. But a year ago today, Maxwell came into his church on Sunday morning and at the close of the service made the astounding proposition that the members of his church volunteer for a year not to do anything without first asking the question, what would Jesus do? And after answering it, to do what in their honest judgment he would do, regardless of what the result might be to them. The effect of this proposition, as it has been met and obeyed by a number of members of the church, has been so remarkable that, as you know, the attention of the whole country has been directed to the movement. I call it a movement because from the action taken today, it seems probable that what has been tried here will reach out into the other churches and cause a revolution in methods, but more especially in a new definition of Christian discipleship. In the first place, Maxwell tells me he was astonished at the response to his proposition. Some of the most prominent members of the church made the promise to do as Jesus would. Among them were Edward Norman, editor of the Daily News, which has made such a sensation in the newspaper world. Milton Wright, one of the leading merchants in Raymond. Alexander Powers, whose action in the matter of the railroads against the interstate commerce laws made such a stir about a year ago. Miss Page, one of Raymond's leading society heiresses, who has lately dedicated her entire fortune, as I understand, to the Christian Daily Paper and the work of reform in the slum district known as the Rectangle. And Miss Winslow, whose reputation as a singer is now national, but who, in obedience to what she has decided to be Jesus' probable action, has devoted her talent to volunteer work among the girls and women who make up a large part of the city's worst and most abandoned population. In addition to these well-known people has been a gradually increasing number of Christians from the First Church and lately from other churches of Raymond. A large portion of these volunteers who pledge themselves to do as Jesus would do comes from the Endeavor Societies. The young people say that they have already embodied in their society pledge the same principle in the words, I promise him that I will strive to do whatever he would have me do. This is not exactly what is included in Maxwell's proposition, which is that the disciple shall try to do what Jesus would probably do in the disciple's place. But the result of an honest obedience to either pledge, he claims, will be practically the same, and he is not surprised that the largest numbers have joined the new discipleship from the Endeavor Society. I am sure the first question you will ask is, what has been the result of this attempt? What has it accomplished, or how has it changed in any way the regular life of the church or the community? You already know something from reports of Raymond that have gone over the country, what the events have been. But one needs to come here and learn something of the changes in individual lives, and especially the change in the church life, to realize all that is meant by this following of Jesus' steps so literally. To tell all that would be to write a long story or series of stories. I am not in a position to do that, but I can give you some idea, perhaps, of what has been done, as told me by friends here and by Maxwell himself. The result of the pledge upon the First Church has been twofold. It has brought upon a spirit of Christian fellowship, which Maxwell tells me never before existed, and which now impresses him as being very nearly what the Christian fellowship of the apostolic churches must have been. And it has divided the church into two distinct groups of members. Those who have not taken the pledge regard the others as foolishly literal in their attempt to imitate the example of Jesus. Some of them have drawn out of the church and no longer attend, or they have removed their membership entirely to other churches. Some are an element of internal strife, and I heard rumors of an attempt on their part to force Maxwell's resignation. I do not know that this element is very strong in the church. It has been held in check by a wonderful continuance of spiritual power, which dates from the first Sunday the pledge was taken a year ago, and also by the fact that so many of the most prominent members have been identified with the movement. The effect on Maxwell is very marked. I heard him preach in our state association 4 years ago. He impressed me at the time as having considerable power in dramatic delivery, of which he himself was somewhat conscious. His sermon was well written and abounded in what the seminary students used to call fine passages. The effect of it was what an average congregation would call pleasing. This morning I heard Maxwell preach again, for the first time since then. I shall speak of that farther on. He is not the same man. He gives me the impression of one who has passed through a crisis of revolution. He tells me this revolution is simply a new definition of Christian discipleship. He certainly has changed many of his old habits and many of his old views. His attitude on the saloon question is radically opposite to the one he entertained a year ago. And in his entire thought of the ministry, his pulpit and parish work, I find he has made a complete change. So far as I can understand, the idea that is moving him on now is the idea that the Christianity of our time must represent a more literal imitation of Jesus, and especially in the element of suffering. He quoted to me in the course of our conversation several times the verses in Peter, "For even hereunto were ye called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, that ye would follow his steps." And he seems filled with the conviction that what our church need today more than anything else is this factor of joyful suffering for Jesus in some form. I do not know as I agree with him altogether, but my dear Caxton, it is certainly astonishing to note the results of this idea as they have impressed themselves upon this city and this church. You ask, how about the results on the individuals who have made this pledge and honestly tried to be true to it? Those results are, as I have said, a part of individual history and cannot be told in detail. Some of them I can give you so that you may see that this form of discipleship is not merely sentiment or fine posing for effect. For instance, take the case of Mr. Powers, who was superintendent of the machine shop of the L&TRR here. When he acted upon the evidence which incriminated the road, he lost his position. And more than that, I learned from my friends here, his family and social relations have become so changed that he and his family no longer appear in public. They have dropped out of the social circle where once they were so prominent. By the way, Caxton, I understand in this connection that the commission, for one reason or another, postponed action on this case, and it is now rumored that the L&TRR will pass into a receiver's hands very soon. The president of the road, who, according to the evidence submitted by Powers, was the principal offender, has resigned, and complications which have risen since point to the receivership. Meanwhile, the superintendent has gone back to his old work as a telegraph operator. I met him at the church yesterday. He impressed me as a man who had, like Maxwell, gone through a crisis in character. I could not help thinking of him as being good material for the church of the first century when the disciples had all things in common. Or take the case of Mr. Norman, editor of the Daily News. He risked his entire fortune in obedience to what he believed was Jesus' action, and revolutionized his entire conduct of the paper at the risk of a failure. I send you a copy of yesterday's paper. I want you to read it carefully. To my mind, it is one of the most interesting and remarkable papers ever printed in the United States. It is open to criticism, but what could any mere man attempt in this line that would be free from criticism? Take it all in all, it is so far above the ordinary conception of a daily paper that I am amazed at the result. He tells me that the paper is beginning to be read more and more by the Christian people of the city. He was very confident of its final success. Read his editorial on the money questions, also the one on the coming election in Raymond, when the question of license will again be an issue. Both articles are of the best from his point of view. He says he never begins an editorial, or, in fact, any part of his newspaper work, without first asking, "What would Jesus do?" The result is certainly apparent. Then there is Milton Wright, the merchant. He has, I am told, so revolutionized his business that no man is more beloved today in Raymond. His own clerks and employees have an affection for him that is very touching. During the winter, while he was lying dangerously ill at his home, scores